This is Atah Durakan returning with part two of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. And we continue on page A7 with the obituaries. Decatur Catherine Ellen Jones Voiles Kraft of Decatur was called home to Jesus on May 17th, 2020 at age 97. She will be laid to rest at Friends Creek Cemetery with a graveside service. A celebration of life will be scheduled at a later date. Tanzas Logan Funeral Services and Care is in charge of the arrangements. Mount Auburn. William L. Willie Walton, 67, of rural Mount Auburn, passed away at 6:45 a.m. Thursday, May 14th, in his residence surrounded by his family. A private graveside service will be held in Todd's Point Cemetery, Findlay, with military honors provided by the U.S. Marine Corps. Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Mount Zion, is assisting the family with services. Messages of condolence may be sent to the family at www.dawson-wyckoff.com. Mr. Walton's military service, he served in the U.S. Marine Corps and was a Vietnam veteran. Bement. David Charles Young, 44, of Bement, passed away at 8 p.m. on Saturday, May 16th, at the Kirby Medical Center, Monticello. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the family is graciously abiding with the suggestions set forth. There will be no visitation or memorial service. Only prayers, cards, or pleasant thoughts for the family during this difficult time. Aaron and Susie Hines of Hines Funeral Home, Bement, has the honor to serve the family of David C. Young. Their website for condolences is www.HinesFuneralHome.com. Okay, we'll continue here. Appreciate your patience here. As you can imagine, the papers take on a different look and feel. Certainly a lot of COVID-19 articles and a lot of articles, if not directly about it, how the virus has impacted stories, and the paper is not as large either, so we're just having to look for articles as we go, so appreciate your patience. There is a photo here on page A8 called the Daily Briefing. New Jersey gym reopens in defiance of lockdown measures, and it shows two men, one with a face covering of an American flag, and next to him, unmasked. Both appear to be doing push-ups, and the gentleman closest to the camera with the mask on looks like he's doing a clap in between. I think they call them Marine Corps push-ups, maybe. At Attilly's Gym in Belmar, New Jersey, reopened for business Monday, defying a state order that shut down non-essential businesses. The owner said the decision to resume business operations was about the question of constitutional rights. Dozens of people came out to show their support for the gym, with many holding signs critical of Democratic Governor Phil Murphy. State Police Superintendent Colonel Patrick Callahan said the gym's owner were issued a court summons over the violation of the governor's executive order, and clients were given a warning. Here, gym co-owner Ian Smith does push-ups with gym members outside the storefront. Early vaccine results encouraging. Study volunteers had antibodies similar to recovered patients. This article is by Marilyn Marchione, Associated Press. An experimental vaccine against the coronavirus showed encouraging results in very early testing, triggering hoped-for immune responses in 8 healthy middle-aged volunteers, its maker announced Monday. Study volunteers, given either a low or medium dose of the vaccine by Cambridge, Massachusetts-based Moderna, Inc., had antibodies similar to those seen in people who have recovered from COVID-19. In the next phase of the study, led by the U.S. National Institutes of Health, researchers will try to determine which dose is best for a definitive experiment that they aim to start in July. In all, 45 people have received one or two shots of the vaccine, which was being tested at three different doses. The kind of detailed antibody results needed to assess responses are only available on 8 volunteers so far. The vaccine seems safe, the company said, but much more extensive testing is needed to see if it remains so. A high-dose version is being dropped after spurring some short-term side effects. The results have not been published and are only from the first of three stages of testing that vaccines and drugs normally undergo. U.S. government officials have launched a project called Operation Warp Speed to develop a vaccine and hopefully have 300 million doses by January. Worldwide, about a dozen vaccine candidates are in the first stages of testing or nearing it. Health officials have said that if all goes well, studies of a potential vaccine might wrap up by very late this year or early next year. More than 4.7 million infections and 315,000 deaths from the coronavirus have been confirmed worldwide since it emerged in China late last year. There are no specific approval treatments, although several are being used on an emergency basis after showing some promise in preliminary testing. This is a very good sign that we can make an antibody that can stop the virus from replicating, Moderna Chief Executive Officer Stéphane Bancel said in an interview. The data from the study couldn't have been better, he said. And we are on to the sports page, section B1. Side by side, Illini twin juniors make most of time in Canada. This article is by Joey Wagner, Champagne. Three-fourths of a home garage in London, Ontario, Canada doubles as a pandemic-proof gym decked out with a squat rack, dumbbells, a cardio machine, and plow boxes that was hand-designed by Illini football twin juniors Sydney and Chase Brown. Of course, they left enough room for their grandmother to park her car while constructing their oasis to be ready whenever the college football season begins. The idea itself took a bit of foreshadowing. They returned home from Champaign on March 14th and quickly realized their stay would be extended because of the COVID-19 global pandemic. So they got ahead of the curve, went to the local fitness depot, and began purchasing equipment that allows them to stay as ready as possible for the upcoming season. It's as close as they can get to being inside the Henry Dale and Betty Smith Football Center without actually being there, and the two-a-day sessions have helped have them in some of the best shape of their lives. They're too competitive for their workouts to be anything that resembles casual. In fact, the garage is simply a new venue to display their ultra-competitiveness. It's a flashback to their youth when they'd race each other up trees or down the street by bike or by foot. Naturally, there's going to be yelling and pushing and prodding. There always has been. We end up getting into arguments, said Sidney Brown, a safety for the Illini. It's just a brother thing. We're pretty intense, especially when it comes to the gym. We're both competitors, so we get into arguments all the time. We're yelling at each other, talking smack to each other. It's something that we do. It pushes both of us. It does get pretty intense when we're in the garage. It's a little more narrowed down to our workouts. It does bring back those memories when we were kids. We're both big kids. But the two are together and haven't yet gotten sick of each other, even in the face of heated arguments. At the end of the day, we might be saying something to each other that's pretty hurtful at one point. But 30 seconds later, we're best friends, said Chase Brown, a running back. We don't take anything to heart, but at the same time, we're brothers and it pushes us. Having him around, I'm just so happy because I have an advantage over other people during this pandemic. More than 2 months into being together all day, every day, with schedules that revolve around workouts, schoolwork, and team meetings, the two aren't sick of each other. Why would they be? They're best friends. On a normal day, they walk to the stadium together, meet between classes, walk home, together and FaceTime if their schedules don't allow for them to walk home in tandem. They live together with quarterback Matt Robinson and wide receiver Donnie Navarro. Being together all the time is like normal life in Champaign. This kind of togetherness has always been the plan, dating back to when they moved to Florida before their junior year in high school, in pursuit of the opportunity to play college football. Sidney Brown signed with Illinois out of high school, and Chase Brown signed with Western Michigan before transferring to Illinois after his freshman season. It never felt like, hey man, just leave me alone or get away from me. It's never been like that between us because we've always been together our entire lives, Sidney Brown said. I haven't really gotten sick of him. It feels like it's just normal having him all the time, looking to my right or to my left and having him just there. I guess that's just us. I haven't really felt like I need to get away from the guy yet, said Chase Brown. We go together well. He doesn't annoy me much. He's my best friend. How could I get sick of him? When they are able to, they said they'll return to Champaign quickly, in part to avoid any potential travel restrictions that could follow. Until then, they'll have the garage and each other. They'll keep going on their workout space, which they say will stay long after they go back to Champaign, to stay physically ready for football, and will keep drawing plays on their respective mirrors to keep mentally sharp. Both say they are intrinsically motivated and would still put forth the same effort if they weren't bonded by their own twin connection, but it certainly helps to have each other around. It's been great, Sidney Brown said. It's a little different because usually we're separated in meetings. We push each other. To have somebody with me who has a similar mindset and the same goals as me in life, it pushes me to get better. We push each other. He pushes me to work harder in workouts. He pushes me to get up and put in the work that I need to do to be successful. It's been great working with my brother, having him with me every day and every single step. And some photos here of the Brown twins. Illinois safety, Sidney Brown, left, wearing number 30, and running back Chase Brown, right, wearing number 28, have been in Canada since March 14th because of the COVID-19 pandemic. They've converted the garage into a weight room to stay in shape. It looks like they're at training camp here. Looks like no pads, looks like practice facility. And then there is a photo here during in-game. Illinois running back Chase Brown makes a play against Rutgers. And The Last Dance, which is very popular. And I, in fact, watched the final episode last night. The Last Dance winners and losers. So that is an article by Phil Rosenthal. So that's a wrap on The Last Dance, the 10-part ESPN series on Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. Jordan, in case you didn't notice, was the big winner. As if he would have had it any other way, the series gave MJ the last word on just about every controversy and aspect of his career. It steered clear of, or merely dabbled lightly on, many potential pitfalls. Even his least appealing qualities, the mind games he played with himself and the unforgiving way he pushed those around him, are cast as positives in the service of success. But over the past 5 weeks, there have been plenty of other winners and losers for anyone keeping score. Here are but a few. Winner, sports media. How many thousands of words have been devoted to The Last Dance over the last few weeks? This series was a godsend, giving everyone something to talk about. ESPN was a double beneficiary in that not only could it turn 2-hour-long episodes each Sunday night into day-long material that wasn't about Tom Brady for the rest of the week, but also the series itself was a hit. Loser Jerry Krause. Despite his critical role in ensuring Jordan was surrounded by the supporting cast necessary to triumph, Krauss, too, was often cast as a villain. The late Bulls general manager's personality made him an easy mark, and the way the dynasty came to an end was unfortunate. But it wasn't all Krauss's fault. He wouldn't have kissed off Coach Phil Jackson, lighting the fuse on Jordan's exit, and the organization's implosion without Jerry Reinsdorf's approval. Winner Phil Jackson, the Bulls coach, probably got no compensation for giving The Last Dance its title. But the series was one long reminder of what a brilliant job he did of managing the egos and varying needs of his players, keeping them focused and getting them to work together. Loser, Bulls fans, great as it was to revel once more in the glory years, it does make the last 22 years seem that much more emptier. That much emptier. Winner, Nike. The mega brand escaped scrutiny despite the many controversies that rose during its MJ-fueled ascendance. Air Jordans poured out of factories overseas, changed the industry and the culture, and were a virtual footnote here, represented by Justin Timberlake and Nas. Loser, Sonny Vaccaro. Vaccaro deserved at least a mention as the visionary who played a critical role in enlisting Jordan for Nike. But he and Nike boss Phil Knight had a falling out, which probably explains why he's absent. For that matter, where was Knight? Winner, the 1997-98 Pacers. The Last Dance reminded everyone just how close the Larry Bird coach team came to ending the Bulls' bid for a second three-peat in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals. Perhaps it elevates Reggie Miller and company in the minds of some. Loser, Isaiah Thomas. While he might be right that the Celtics treated the Bad Boys Pistons as shabbily in passing their mantle as the Pistons did to the Bulls, this series in no way made him look good. Winner, Hugh Hollins. The Jordanless Bulls' 1994 playoff loss to the Knicks was distilled to Scottie Pippen sitting out in the final 1.8 seconds when Phil Jackson opted to have Tony Kukoc take the final shot in Game 3, which Kukoc nailed for the win, and the Knicks taking the series in 7 games. Completely unmentioned was Hollis, who called Pippen for a phantom foul of Hubert Davis that cost the Bulls Game 5. The Last Dance forgot Hugh. Bulls fans haven't. Loser, the White Sox. If you buy the proposition that Jordan eventually would have made it to the big leagues had he not circled back to basketball because he didn't want to cross a picket line, Major League Baseball's 1994-95 labor stalemate cost the Sox even more than a World Series shot. Having someone as popular and charismatic as Jordan would have been great for the franchise. Loser, wives and girlfriends. Apparently, there were no wives or even girlfriends associated in any meaningful way with the Bulls in the Jordan era except for Carmen Electra. Winner, sports documentaries. The success of The Last Dance surely will lead to a rash of other nonfiction sports productions. One imagines a documentary on the life of Steve Kerr getting greenlighted by the end of this sentence. Loser, the other teammates, Ron Harper, Luke Longley, and Jason Caffey, were among 9 Bulls players to appear in more regular season games than Kerr in 1997-98. It didn't translate to a lot of screen time for them, though. Harper at least got to talk about playing against Jordan. Winner, Sam Smith. The brutally competitive side of Jordan shouldn't have been a surprise to anyone who has read or even heard of former Tribune writer Smith's The Jordan Rules. The series should have helped sell a few copies. Loser, Walter Payton. Former Chicago resident Barack Obama recalled that with Jordan joining the Bulls in 1984, suddenly you have a sports figure that puts Chicago on the map and that eventually was able to rally around. But the Bears' Payton had been doing that since 1975. Winner, Gatorade. Because that Be Like Mike jingle in the back rattling around in your head again for the first time in years? Good luck getting rid of it again. Winner, cigars. While The Last Dance refrained from showing Jordan drinking Miller Lite, despite implying it was his post-game beverage of choice rather than Gatorade, it unhesitatingly showed him with his smokes in the locker room and on the golf course. Loser, Jordan's golf game. We didn't see that much of it in The Last Dance, but the documentary reports on the great sums of cash he lost on the links and, in one amusing clip, shows him nailing someone's cart with an errant shot. And finally, loser Lance Armstrong. ESPN is following The Last Dance the next 2 weeks with Lance, a documentary on the scandal-scarred cyclist. Good luck following MJ. Not even doping can help win this one. That's a really good recap. Okay. Well, and really back to live sports. The first race steers clear of potholes. This article's by Alex Andreev from the Tribune News Services. Darlington race winner Kevin Harvick described his trip to Victory Lane on Sunday with a word that's probably never been previously used to describe the experience. Awkward, Harvick said. Usually, you get out of the car and the crowd is screaming and yelling. Sunday, out of the car, it was like, well, I don't really know what to do here, the 50-time Cup Series race winner said, adding that he did not know whether to put on a mask for his post-race interview with Fox NASCAR pit reporter Regan Smith, who stood holding a microphone at a distance while wearing a mask of his own. Look, I've been around this deal for a long time, Harvick continued. This is not like anything I've ever experienced. Unlike this year's Daytona 500, in which President Donald Trump was in attendance to serve as the Grand Marshal, it was state health officials rather than Secret Service who patrolled the grounds to ensure the event's safety as NASCAR held its first race back amid the global coronavirus pandemic. I can tell you it's very similar to coming back after 9/11, Harvick said. But there was still a key difference. That day had 100,000 fans in the stands. Now you have no fans, he said. Despite the awkward and isolated moments for those at the track as well as for those watching from home, moments that will continue, at least through late June as NASCAR runs its other upcoming events without fans, the sport's sanctioning body saw the event as a success. None of the roughly 900 individuals on site were denied entry at the raceway screening area, and NASCAR Executive Vice President Steve O'Donnell said that no one needed to be reprimanded for failing to wear a mask. I think the industry really came together and did a tremendous job to enable us to get to the race, O'Donnell said. I think it just felt a little bit odd with the garage area because it was so scaled down in terms of personnel. All in all, I thought it went really, really well. Media members and drivers expressed the same sentiment. I'm probably one of the first guys to criticize NASCAR on a lot of things, and usually rightfully so, number two driver Brad Keselowski said. But in this case, they deserve a pretty big pat on the back. Keselowski said he was blown away that NASCAR was able to pull it off. Up until probably 2 or 3 hours before the race, I was ready for something to go wrong, Keselowski said. Like, all right, what is it going to be? Is someone going to be sick? Is there going to be somebody boycotting outside the racetrack? Nobody did. Nothing bad happened. They pulled this thing off, and it feels a little like a Christmas miracle. For that reason, Keselowski said, I think NASCAR is going to come out okay. The sport will come out okay. Broadcast viewership numbers also pointed in a positive direction. The Real Heroes 400 race at Darlington averaged 6.32 million viewers, according to Fox Sports. It was the most watched competitive sports event on cable television since this year's Daytona 500, which reached more than 7 million viewers. That's not a major surprise since NASCAR wasn't competing with other sports leagues that would traditionally be in season at this time, such as the NBA, NHL, and MLB, and was likely able to capture some of that audience. A great day for sports in general, Hall of Fame driver and Fox NASCAR analyst Jeff Gordon said. People connect to sports, and people connected to what was going on out there on Sunday. However, Darlington was the first race of many on NASCAR's remaining schedule, and that collective sigh of relief could be temporary, as only time will tell how successful the event truly was in terms of positive COVID-19 tests. NASCAR is scheduled to run 8 more races over the next 2 weeks, beginning with an Xfinity Series race Tuesday night, followed by another cup race at Darlington on Wednesday, and then the Coca-Cola 600 at Charlotte Motor Speedway this Sunday. Okay, let's see here. This year it won't be the Open. Doug Ferguson, Associated Press. U.S. Open no longer open eliminates qualifying for major. The U.S. Open might feel more like a closed shop this year. The COVID-19 pandemic, which already has postponed the U.S. Open at Winged Foot from June to September, has forced the USGA to do away with qualifying for the first time since 1924. Open qualifying is the hallmark of golf's second oldest championship. The USGA often points out that typically half of the 156-man field has to go through either 36-hole qualifying or 18-hole and 36-hole qualifying. It even invested in a marketing campaign that was rolled out in February titled From Many, One, to illustrate that more than 9,000 people apply to play in the U.S. Open, eventually yielding to one winner. The USGA has lost 10 championships to the coronavirus. It said Monday that four more were canceled, the U.S. Mid-Amateur and Women's Mid-Amateur and U.S. Senior Amateur and U.S. Senior Women's Amateur. The USGA did not announce Monday how other players would become exempt. Among those who have yet to qualify is Phil Mickelson, a runner-up six times in the only major he hasn't won. Mickelson said in February he would not ask the USGA for an exemption and that if he didn't qualify or become exempt, he wouldn't play. Winged Foot is where Mickelson made double bogey on the final hole in 2006 to lose by one. The field presumably will be smaller because of the later date, though the USGA did not mention the field size in its April 6 announcement that the U.S. Open was moving to September 17th to 20th at Winged Foot in Mamaroneck, New York. As you can imagine, this was an incredibly difficult decision as qualifying is a cornerstone of USGA championships, said John Bodenhamer, Senior Managing Director of Championships for the USGA. We take great pride in the fact that many thousands typically enter to pursue their dream of qualifying for the U.S. Open, and we deeply regret that they will not have the opportunity this year. Bodenhamer said no qualifying provides the best path forward to holding the U.S. Open. And we wrap up this part on the weather section, page B8, WCI four-day forecast today, high of 68, mostly cloudy and rain, winds northeast 10 to 25, tonight 52, mostly cloudy and cool, winds northeast 10 to 20, Wednesday, high of 69, low of 52, partly cloudy and mild, winds northeast 10 to 20, east 10 to 20, Thursday, high of 71, low of 55, mostly sunny and warm, wind east 5 to 15. And Friday, high of 76, low of 61, partly cloudy and warm, wind southeast 5 to 15. Regional outlook, a decent amount of clouds today will with spotty rain and light showers late morning and into this afternoon will make temperatures remain below normal. Well, that has brought us to the end of the second half hour. I've enjoyed reading with you from my home studio. This has been a Todd Durakon with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. And until we can read together again, I hope you stay safe and take care.